So hello everyone and welcome to another week of our weekly sessions. And today's topic is called There Is Only One Book Worth Reading, The Mind. It's a great topic because there can be a tendency to read lots of Dharma books, watch heaps of YouTube videos on, you know, different spiritual talks and topics, but our sentient experience comes from within. So I'm very keen to hear that more. And we are blessed to have Venerable Metaji speaking with us today. So Venerable Metaji believes that he's a very fortunate bhikkhu to be given the opportunity to ordain late in life at Bodhiana. His lifelong search for absolute truth started in his teens in Europe. He's now in his mid-60s and believes he only found the real teachings when he touched Theravada Buddhism 10 years ago. So he feels blessed to have Ajahn Brahmavamsa as his preceptor and access to other marvelous teachers like Ajahn Bamali, Bhante Sujato, and Bhikkhu Bodhi. So his name, Metaji, comes from a monk in the time of the Buddha and translates as victory through loving kindness. That is the aspiration he wants to fulfill in his practice and in meeting anyone everywhere. So what an inspiring aspiration for us all. Thank you. And as usual, we will begin with a guided meditation and talk by Bhante, and then Mayan will facilitate the Q&A discussions towards the end. So on to you, Venerable.
Thank you. Thanks to everybody online. Thanks to everybody here in the center. It's a joy to actually finally get here. So, you know, wanted to come for a number of years. I lived in Sydney for the best part of 23 years, I think it was, before I got the chance to go off to Bodhinyana. So Sydney was very good for my life. And, you know, I have a lot of appreciation for all the Buddhists have helped me on the path and I've sort of met, you know, ever since I discovered it. What I'd like to encourage you tonight is that, you know, I'm here to be of service to you. So I want to share as much as I've kind of learned or share, you know, teachings that I've heard from Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahmali and the others. And I kind of propose to do that meditation and share some things that I've learned and seems to be benefit to those that I talk with, you know, especially in WA, but I have done a few talks internationally now. So we'll do the meditation. Then I want to tell you why I picked the title. And hidden in the title, it said there, people get extra points, you know, gold stars or a banana. If you can tell me who's phrase that is and why they said it. So we'll save that riddle for later. So do a Dharma talk and then, you know, move quickly to a Q&A that you can ask any question on any topic you want. Yeah. Now, I've learned a couple of things in meditation. So before we actually, I ask you to close your eyes, I want you to do a couple of things with me that seem to benefit a number of meditators. The first thing is I want you to sit silently for a minute and set an intention for yourself about what experience you would like to have in that meditation. So just ground yourself internally and ask yourself, set an intention of what you want to achieve in the meditation. Hopefully everybody's got an intention. The second thing I want to ask you to do is think the most loving kindness moment in your life of metta, loving kindness that you gave to someone else or loving kindness that you received. I don't want you to think it. I want you to find the feeling and place that in your heart. Now, before we do a really helpful body scan, what I've suggested to you there is you have two anchors. One is an intention, one is the feeling of metta. That if the meditation for you is restless or you have disturbing thoughts, you can go back to one of those intentions, the feeling or some words, and use those to dissolve any intrusive thoughts that you've got. The third thing that I've really noticed is that people rush around a lot. So they might jump into the meditation and they've just got off the train or their mind's been running at 100 miles an hour. So time isn't allowed to give your body the opportunity to relax before we go and look at the mind. So let's now close our eyes. And we're going to do a body scan for about 5 minutes before we go into the meditation proper. Body scan is about giving metta to yourself. So I've given each one of you online and here in the center, I've given you this beautiful light probe. It's very small, but very intricate. And its sole purpose in life is to go into any vein, any cell, any tissue, and spread metta whenever it finds tightness, stiffness, something that you need to let go of. So we'll start with the toes, the ankle, the soles of the feet. And we're looking for tightness that we may have missed during the course of the day. We want to relax the body with metta. So if you find a little bit of tightness, soreness, you just might want to zero in there with the light probe and see if you can dissolve it with kindness and gentleness. And even say internally, perhaps to yourself, thank you, feet. You've looked after me so well all the days of my life, or thousands and thousands of kilometers. I do appreciate you. Thank you. And we take a look into the calves and the shins. See if there's any tightness there. Something that needs an internal caress. The light probe can zero in if you find a knot or a twinge. And you're sending love to that point in your body. Then we've got the hamstrings and the quads. Really powerful muscles. Very important, perhaps in sports. But they can get very tight and a bit sore from hours of living a sedentary life. Just scan from the knee on both sides, perhaps. Do I need to adjust my position? Give a wiggle. Try and let something go. It's my time now. I want it to be full of metta. the glutes, the waist, the lower back, they can carry a lot of tension. So Ajahn Brahm would say, give it a little bit of wiggle, where you're kind of up on one side or down on the other. What's going to make your body feel really relaxed the next 20 minutes or so? And the light probe might just pick out a bit of internal massage there or here. It's going to smooth the process. Remember, if you find anything, the only instruction is to send metta to that point. Let it dissolve with kindness. Don't force anything. Then we circumnavigate from the back and to the stomach, the sternum, all the wonderful organs inside that keep us going, the heart, the lungs. Just have a little scan around, have it as a bit of fun. We're just relaxing the body and the senses, gently, peacefully, kindly. Now the shoulders, we hold a lot of tension in the shoulders. Some people like to move the shoulders up almost like they're touching their ears, and they're kind of going, wow, some big chunks of stiffness there. How can I let it go? Flex one shoulder to the other. Treat it with kindness. Thank you, shoulders, for carrying such a burden. I'm really thankful for your strength. Help me every moment of the day. We go down the arms and the forearms to the fingers. Remarkable skills the fingers have. All the things we can do to get by in the world. Let's see if your fingers are going to be comfortable for the next few minutes. Whether the fingers, the arms, the forearms, biceps, they need any love and attention. And the inside of the neck, perhaps give it a silent internal caress. See if there's tension there or in the jaw. I want to rotate the neck a little bit or flex the jaw. New parts of tension that you find that you're just going to give some really good tender loving care to in this session. People are surprised that we carry quite a bit of tension around our mouths. So, like probe, if it finds something, it senses something. It can send metta and heat, warmth and kindness. Make some of those creases, that tension disappear. Also around the eyes and the brow. You can sometimes see it in people's faces that they're carrying a lot of tension. You kind of know without them saying anything. But look after yourself first. This is about metta for you. While you all had your eyes closed, I put a basket down next to you with a big fluffy blanket in it. I want you to imagine that you've got a flip-top head. You reach inside and you take out your overworked brain. And you give it a caress and you place it down in the blanket and wrap it kindly. Perhaps caress it again and say, thank you for all the work you do on my behalf. I'm just going to be quiet and still. Any thoughts that come up are none of my business, and I'll deal with them later. I asked you to come up with an image of metta, a really profound, wonderful experience of metta. And I encourage you now to put that into the middle of your heart center. And for the next 3 minutes on your own, in silence, make that feeling bigger and bigger. So if you can find a way to encourage it to be a big, warm ball of heat and kindness and metta. We'll do that in silence for the next 3 minutes. The last instruction before we go silent for 15 minutes is to continue to keep that metta strong and really powerful. Now send it to any part of your body that you want in silence. If you need to, if you feel it's waning, come back to that image, that profound moment, and build that up again. And then when you're ready, send it to whatever part of your body that you would like. We'll sit in silence for about 15 minutes. Enjoy. keep the metta strong. Keep it warm and kind and loving. Now send that metta to everybody on Zoom, to everyone in this room. And share metta unconditionally. We come to the close of the meditation. Just as Ajahn Brahm recommends, before you leave each meditation, just check in with that thought and ask yourself, how do I feel now? What's changed for me in these 30 minutes together? It's to take your right hand and put it over your left shoulder. Your left hand and put it over your right shoulder. Give yourself a really good metta hug to finish. Open your eyes when you're ready. I hope that was a contribution of a number of things that I want to talk about now. For many years, I dug myself in and say I was an overthinker. I always thought that thinking would answer every solution. And if I thought harder and harder, then I'd definitely get, you know, a beautiful solution, something that was really creative. That can weigh you down. It can make it really tiring. May actually not be very helpful to you. And the longer I've been a monastic, I do believe in the expression of the Buddha saying there are only four emotional states that we need to live in 24/7. Metta, which has got, you know, great coverage. Everybody likes that one. Karuna, compassion. Mudita, which has never had a good press team. And most people forget sometimes that it's even there. Sympathetic joy for the success of others. And then upekkha, which historically has been translated as equanimity. But in the present day, we kind of prefer contentment. That if you're easily contented in all circumstances, you won't make big demands of the world. And if the demands come to you, you won't get sucked into greed and hatred in particular. The Buddha famously said to the monks, the leaves in my hand and the leaves in the forest, which has the most? And the monks probably looked at him a bit askance and said, well, the leaves in the tree, you know, around us, master. Correct, he said. The leaves in my hand are all that you need to know. I know a lot else about the world, but only what I've taught you is what you need to concentrate on, nothing else. So some scholars would say, you know, some humanists, some atheists would say the Buddha was probably the first psychologist in the present age, and you can dive into many suttas and you'll find the answers to anger, greed, hatred, arguments, relationships, how to look after your parents, how to look after children. So it's taken me a long while to understand that the mind can be a heaven or a hell. But we get to choose. We're always at choice. And now what I try and tell people when they're looking at meditation, meditation works when you get out of the way. If you try and force the meditation to happen, it won't. And your mind will run through habits and preferences that it's had for a very long time. So if you can get the you out of the way, if you put that down for a period of time, much like the exercise of, I'll take my brain out, I'll put it in a fluffy blanket, you know, wrapped in a basket. Then you set up the conditions to be peaceful and kind to yourself. Whatever would arise during the meditation. The other thing I'd like to dob myself in for is when I went to Bodhinyana, I was just like I'd been in lay life, that I thought the next book would give me the answer. That if I went through hundreds and hundreds of podcasts or I listened to 1,000 of Ajahn Brahm's talks, the next one would make me peaceful. So I was a junkie. I was a junkie in the world for information and knowledge. And I was never satisfied after a day or two that that book had solved my malaise, you know, the suffering in life. And interestingly, when I got the opportunity to be a monk, I had to get rid of 2,000 books in 5 weeks. 1,000 I put in containers and shipped north to a good friend, John Barter, who was an ex-monk, because he said he would set up a Buddhist library. And there was the odd pang, you know, that you were letting this go. It was a part of you. And it was almost like you had these children and, you know, here's Ajahn Chah and here's Sumedho and all that type of stuff. But I'd honestly have to say that I had them as possessions, but some I hadn't looked at for years. And probably more importantly, I didn't sit with one for a while and say, what's the practice in there that I need to understand? Who should I talk to if my mind is really busy? The guy who said there's only one book to read, that's the mind, is Ajahn Chah. And the reason he said it was he had to leave school in level four. He left in level four because the family was really poor and he had to go and work the fields, and I think there were multiple children. But in playtime, he wanted to be a monk. Every time they played, you know, cowboys and Indians, whatever, in the Thai village, he always wanted to be the monk. And because his literacy wasn't high, he was concerned that the Western mind would be grasping for the solution, like, give me the computer program, give me the software, give me the media, and I'll get it to change me. What he was advocating through the many exercises, and I'll answer this in the Q&A if you're interested, the exercises that he was continually trying to put on those monks, and I think why so many Westerners went and they set up what Pananachat, and then monks in that lineage went to many parts of the world, fortunately. He was always trying to get them to look at their own minds and the reaction they had to an event. He didn't want them to sit with books and study so much. He wanted to get the balance right and said, some of you, when you touched meditation the first time, when you notice how busy your mind was minute after minute, quite a few ran away and said, this isn't for me. I'll go and watch Netflix. I'll go down the pub. I'll go and, you know, see a soccer game. But he wanted to encourage them to sit with it and be patient, like you don't get results overnight. I'll share one classic one now. Ajahn Chah was going away for a few days, and he said to the monks, you know, we've been doing a lot of building projects, and we got this big mound of sand. While I'm gone, I would like the monks to move it 300 meters from there to this other part of the monastery. So the monks did that. They had to work like 12 hours a day. It was a very hot time of year. They were sweating, a little bit of swearing. Some monks didn't want to do it. You know, I didn't become a monk to do this. And they moved it all, and they were going to have a day or two off. And Ajahn Liam, who was looking after the monastery where Ajahn Chah was away, said, oh no, you put it in the wrong spot. I want you to move it over here, 300 meters in a different direction. And a couple of them are going, oh no, this is going to be another 3 days in the heat of the day, and we got to get into this. So they did it. And Ajahn Chah came back on the ninth day, and he said, what did you put it there for? I told you to put it here. Move it back. So a third trip, yeah, at this. Now, some of the monks were starting to lose it. And one of Ajahn Brahm's favorite moments is, you know, puffing and puffing, and some words are happening between the monks. And one monk says to Ajahn Brahm, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking is what makes it difficult. It's trying to sort of resonate with, like, what's going on. So is this something that you've really got to upset about? But if it wasn't moving the sand, it might be a difficult person who comes to the monastery. And if you don't slow down and look at your own mind, you haven't got any comprehension of what are your triggers, what habits and preferences that you've dealt up. Sorry, have you developed over the years? And are they wholesome or are they unwholesome? Ajahn Chah then would try and understand how each monk was different, and how he could softly, most days, try and get them to examine it and see what was going on. So, you know, the Buddha makes a declaration in the suttas, you know, the person in front of you now seems to have a lustful mind, an angry mind, a contracted mind. You can't do all of that or even counsel until you perhaps understand your own. So, you know, this is the fifth flight of my trip. So every flight I've been on, I kind of notice and smile internally when they say, if the oxygen mask should happen to fall, put it on yourself first before you help somebody else. And if you don't have, you know, the knowledge, the experience of yourself, which could be different than the monk sitting next to me or the lay person that's, you know, really helping BSWA, then it's very difficult to be of service and help somebody else. Now, why don't we do it? Why don't we just kind of look at that small handful of leaves and say, I'm not asked to read heaps of books. I don't need to go to lots of psychologists. I'm be asked to sit down quietly and observe the body, the feelings, the perceptions, and the mind states. The Buddha didn't extend it out to 36. You have these small lists. They're probably small lists because everything was being translated orally. And four wasn't too many to remember. But in recent times, I've really noticed that people think meditation is an exercise they must do to themselves and don't probably get the core message that in meditation, if the negative states come up, you're supposed to intervene right there and make them positive. So if they go across our mind, you know, like the analogy that's used, that clouds are going over, you can sometimes feel an attraction before the thought happens. It's almost like a magnet. You know, that one's going to be a good one, and that's an absolute shocker. But you still allow it to come. And then when it shows up, I better do something about that now, or I'll just write down, I've got to talk to my mother, or I better put the dog out, or X, Y, and Z. Yeah. A core part of the teaching, I think, is notice the negative states. Don't go and try and sort it out right now, but move to where the wholesome ones are, or something you can give yourself. The four divine abodes. So what's the antidote, you know, to anger and difficultness? Mainly metta. What's the right solution if you're kind of feeling suffering for yourself or other people? Compassion. What's a good basis of you feel a bit envious and jealous about somebody's success? Well, mudita, I celebrate in the fact that they've got the promotion, they've got the new car. Their promotion and their car has got nothing to do with me. If they're a wholesome, good person, if I like the characteristics that they got, the qualities that they have, that's a better antidote other than, you know, I don't wish to drop into envy or jealousy. And then, you know, the more subtle ones, resentment. I gave a talk last night on mudita, and I kind of wanted to share that in the Western world, a long way from Australia, there's papers now calling sort of envy and jealousy the crab mentality. So that's fascinating. The crab mentality, what's that about? Well, if you put a number of crabs into a bucket and watch them try and get out, if one crab's doing well, the others will knock it down. They'll keep pulling it down. They don't work together to get out. It's like, oh, if you're ahead of me, bang, get out of the way. Now it's my turn. So in the crab mentality, in a sense, everybody loses. Somebody translates this in the paper I'm reading. They said, oh, the Australians have got this thing called tall poppy syndrome. Tall poppy syndrome is someone seems to be doing really well. We might choose to denigrate them or discredit them. It's about chopping down the tall poppy syndrome. Because when you Google it, you find thousands of pages on metta and thousands of meditations, and the same with compassion, but you find very few on mudita. Scientists in the present day have been trying to study this group in the University of Melbourne for one contemplative study center. Recommend that to people to give it a look. They were asking themselves, if someone chose to have appreciative joy to someone else, could you measure it? And you can. So they find if they put electrodes on someone that if you have appreciative joy to someone else, that tends to set off the reward centers in the brain. And they can see the brain glow with an internal happiness that's got nothing attached to materiality or the other event. They can now see that it affects health and longevity. And someone who's generally happy tends to be happier full time. It's not something they just switch on and off. They've chosen to be in that state. The ones that really impressed me of late was a study that was done of white school teachers in ghetto areas in America, where they mainly had black students. And the teachers who put the energy, the appreciative joy into those students and helped them get good marks and told them how good they were and how much they enjoyed having them as students, the students performed better. And then the teachers got a surprise. I'm not surprised. The teachers got a surprise. They got lots of job offers. Because if you could do it in the ghetto and you could do it and lift the standards, and everybody seems to be happy, and the kid says, you know, my teacher really believed in me, and there was a lot of fun and humor. And then the last one to share for now on that particular characteristic, surgeons, doctors and nurses, especially in hospital situations, if they practiced mudita and had joy for the patient and didn't see it as a chemical solution to fix, if they went in and they wanted to understand something about the patient and their cultural background, and they had appreciative joy that this was a fellow human being, maybe suffering, but I can alleviate some of that. And that study says there's less burnout and stress. They knew how to deal with every situation, and they got more plaudits from the parents, the grandchildren of those that they were trying to look after. So in the present day, I saw them in the last few days, I've got a son of 27 who's up in the Tambourine Mountain behind Glucos, and I've got a daughter in Sydney. And for 6 years, I've not been able to persuade them that the world has speeded up. And there are lots and lots of distractions that take you out of yourself. And because they act fairly quickly, you'll forget that you can meditate any time of the day, 24/7. I know for a fact that, you know, the iPhones and the screens and the social media, they were designed on a gambling algorithm. The goal of those social media sites is to get you to keep coming back, to make you be an addict. So when it kind of rolls around, imagine a poker machine, and in the poker machine, you're thinking the next post will make you really happy or give you some, you know, profound sort of knowledge. When we get into those distractions, they're often very hard to put down. Have you noticed that in the middle of the night, you may go back to a social media post that you remember from earlier in the day or something you saw on Netflix or a bad piece of media? So we need to inoculate the mind by being careful about the things that we let in on a daily basis. Ajahn Brahm, I think, made a spectacular contribution that people don't understand yet. The suttas talk about consciousness, but we would say there's six consciousnesses. There are the five of, you know, sight, smell, taste, ears, touch, whatever. The sixth one is the mind, but you can't have an experience as a human being if one of those senses matches up with the mind. And it happens so fast that you don't realize it's happened. You don't sit back and say, is this going to be a good experience, or ought I do something different? Mm-hmm. I'll give you a quick example. I said to my daughter on Saturday morning, do you have a favorite fruit? And she said, well, strawberries. And she said, is there a fruit that you would never touch, that you just don't like it? And she said, pawpaw. So I said, how did you decide the strawberry was the preference and pawpaw you don't really like? At a base level, they're both just fruits. But what the mind does is go and put labels on lots and lots of things and say, you know, I like Sydney, but I don't like Melbourne. You know, they're the other lot. Or I like coming to the Meta Center, but you're not going to see me at a pop concert anymore. We develop the habits and preferences. So then we overlay that on the mind, and we don't allow the mind to appear and then say, okay, how would I advocate that? How would I look after being peaceful, gentle, and kind to every moment? Being peaceful, kind, and gentle to every moment. Am I only going to do that in the Meta Center? Am I going to do it when I see my partner shortly? Or do I just compartmentalize it? It's now meditation time, so I'll do that. But once it's out of the way, I can watch Netflix. You know, my researchers tell me that Succession is a big thing on Netflix, right? 40 years ago, when I was heavily involved in the marketing for a UK bank that doesn't exist anymore, I went to the scriptwriters who were saying, oh, you should invest in these shows. This is where you should place your advertising money. And I said to them, yeah, I'm really interested. You know, I've done a bit of research before I come here. How do you develop the characters and the plot in this particular series? Well, not bothered about that, they said. My job is to produce 27 emotional moments across the 24 minutes of the 30-minute program. And I've got to produce something just before they go to the ad break that will bring people back afterwards and is either strong desire, suspicion. And I went, yeah, of course. So people get hooked up on Succession. At base level, it's only pixels. It might be based on the Murdochs, but they're only actors. Over the years, the shows have got stronger and stronger. You know, the content, you know, it's got to be a bit more violent. You know, sex plays a large part, profanity, all those things. And I found that some people go to the coffee area the following morning, and you're not in the in crowd unless you watched Succession the previous night. So this hasn't got any truth in it, but it's really important to remain in the in crowd that you know what's going on in that universe. Now, meditation takes time. It requires patience. One of the joys of going to Ajahn Brahm, I didn't have much choice at 60, but you know, I got lucky. One of the main reasons for going to Ajahn Brahm is it was quite clear he was a happy, funny monk who knew something. And part of the reason that he uses a lot of humor with people initially is to try to get them to relax in the present moment. If he can sense that their body chemistry has kind of changed, then he might gently probe, you know, why have you come to see me today? And he's looking gently and quickly to zero in on the mind and what that mind state is. During COVID and afterwards, we probably saw 30 or 40% more people who said they had mental illness. And often it's difficult to convince someone that if all phenomena is important, if that was one of the big leaves that the Buddha was trying to teach, when someone says they're depressed, that's an identity that they've chosen. And they believe that's them, and they can't get rid of it. And yet, they won't be depressed all day long. They might miss the happy moment, you know, that they saw on television, or the phone call from the granddaughter who was sort of checking out that they were okay. So a big job for us as monks and nuns is to say to people, you're really asked to put the body down and the senses and work gently with the mind sufficient that you can see what the patterns are. And there are better answers that come out of silence than they do out of the thinking. Thinking is an approximation. It's never the full truth. You can see that when you have an argument in a relationship or even at the office. I'm dead right on this. I know I'm perfectly right. And you're not. And if you want to be right all the time, you're probably going to have a difficult relationship and not going to be able to, you know, get sort of team building go. But when we have a difficult, when Ajahn Brahm in particular might say, I've got a difficult issue to solve, he'll receive the question on the Monday, but he'll say, I'll probably need to meditate on this on Thursday. And then I'll come back and I'll seek a number of views. We'll do this as a community, but I'll see what I think is wholesome going forward. I'll see if this is going to harm anybody. We as monks have the ability to detach, you know, for long periods of time and do that. But I'd recommend that you take meditation breaks during the day, even if only for 5 minutes. I was telling a group earlier today, famous story in New York, a secretary was asked by this top attorney to empty a closet, get rid of everything in the closet. Closet would go back about a foot and a half, 2 feet. And she told him it was done after about a week. And he said, okay, I want you to lock me in there at 2 o'clock every day for half an hour. I'm going to give meditation a go. And she did it, and anybody rang up and said, oh, the boss is very busy at the moment. He's in an important meeting. She played along with it. Then after a week or two, she said, I've ruled out the diary for the rest of the year. The 2 p.m. slot becomes sacrosanct. She said, oh, that's interesting. Why do you do that? She goes, when you come out at 2:30, you're a far kinder, gentle, more observant human being. And I kind of noticed recently that some of your best customers have asked to come in the afternoon and not the morning. He made it sacrosanct. When I was, you know, not traveling too well before I became a monk, I chose Balmoral Beach at 9 o'clock below Mosman as a happy place. If I had my happy place to go to, it was a meditative experience. I got there at 9 o'clock. I had the whole beach to myself. There was nobody else. There's an island on Balmoral, juts out between two stretches of sand. You can sit there and you kind of notice that there's a strong ozone effect. There's a very kind of nurturing, sort of healing atmosphere. You do that for a few minutes and you notice that your sort of body is becoming calmer and your thoughts are going down a bit. And then I start counting the waves that are coming in. So, you know, some of those waves come a long way, you know, they've come through the heads, and which one's going to splash next, you know. And if I still need to decompress a little bit, I can take my socks and shoes off and go and paddle in the ocean. There's a different texture to that, you know, water on your feet, the sand, the movement of it. So please, if you can, try and find your own happy place, which is also shorthand for meditation, because, you know, under Ajahn Brahm, the key principle is meditation should be fun and relaxing. If you don't have it as being fun and relaxing, some days you're just going to say, this isn't going to work. Turn on Netflix, go out, you know, to the pub, or bring a friend up, you know, just to gossip, you know, for an hour. So Ajahn Chah, bless him, tried all sorts of ways of getting someone just to look at their own mind. Forget about the books, forget about the videos, just be with that. Then if it's difficult, it gives you more suffering. Talk to people about the antidotes. When the antidotes start to happen, they build and build and build. And 24/7, you can live in a more happy, wholesome way. And surprise, surprise, other people notice that in you and they want to be around you. Don't let them suck your energy, but kind of now you've got, you know, probably the most important skill on the planet, which you can share with other people. So that's probably enough of the reflections. I kind of left 25 minutes for Q&A. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to give a Dharma talk.
Thanks, Monte. So we'll open it up for questions now. If anyone wanted to write a question in the chat, otherwise feel free to unmute yourself and ask a question. Or also anyone in the audience here at the centre.
I'm so grateful first to the Dharma. I want to from tonight's teaching, could I just summarize it as loop weaving? Loop weaving.
Yes.
Is that the key takeaway?
Okay. So firstly, thanks for the question. So that is the case. I've tried to do different things differently with people to try and get them out of their mind fairly quickly. So I was trying to get you within 5 minutes to drop the mind and go into the metta. So if you go into the feeling was positioned inside of you. You had an ability to move it around. And if you would go with the feeling, the thoughts would start to dissipate. So that is a form of looking within. But I was trying to give you an experience that you could copy and make yourself. And I obviously can't pick the metta that you would choose. But over time, you might find better at metta and metta and say, well, I'll use this time and see if I can build it in my chest first, make it really strong, glowing, you know, like really hot, and then send it to parts of the body that need it, that you think will sort of really benefit. Now, there's not a lot of thinking in that, right? What I try to convey to everybody is it's a feeling. And Ajahn Brahm has said many times, meditation isn't about thinking. It's not a thinking religion. It's a feeling religion. And you can feel yourself into the space. And if you get the feelings, then you notice that thinking hasn't helped you. Feelings can be a bridge. So metta, compassion, they're all a feeling that you can build up yourself. So, you know, when I say intervene, if you've got a real feel for what that feels like viscerally, textually, you can just pull it down when you're in that situation that you're being confronted with envy, jealousy, anger, and the like. So all the answers we need are on this fathom long body. Yeah. That was a quote from the Buddha.
Thank you.
I was wondering, given your experience working, you know, in the high fly executive positions, whatever, how do you move or how do you transition from a very cerebral job to something so contemplative?
Great question. Now I would say it wasn't high flying at all. It was highly stressful. And something that society encourages to do, you know, if you get status or you're given responsibilities by a board, you'll be able to influence everybody else. You have power. I don't believe that at all anymore, because people can choose not to go with your agenda or resist it. Yeah. So fortunately for me in this lifetime, I kind of saw through that. And I have a real concern for the world that corporations have been running the world and some have been very malevolent in terms of how they use information in those social media streams to get you to buy things that you don't want or follow a particular policy. The truth of the answer has only come in the last couple of years going, I believe the books, the courses, the $5,000, you know, conference that I went to would give me the answers that I needed. But a big wake-up call for me, I ran a charity on the Northern Beaches as my last job. And I asked myself whether I could influence and put Buddhist principles into that company. If I said to all the staff, you could come and do meditation with me at 8:30, and that was the start of the day, and we were paying for that, that was, you know, free. And to see if they come twice a week, and, you know, then we'd do sessions on loving kindness. After 4 weeks, none of the staff would do it, saying, oh, it's boring, I'm not getting any results. And what I really started to understand fairly quickly is, if somebody doesn't want to do something, there's nothing much, you know, that you could do. So I think I've run lots of experiments, and I've had to find, you know, really good people, junior monks, you know, I think are going to be great teachers, got great character, lots of humor, they understand the suttas and stuff, and say, you know, my mind's a bit wild at the moment. So, well, you shouldn't be putting on the ASA conference, and you shouldn't go to Canberra, and you shouldn't work on this. But now I see that as practice, that before I was trying to get status or money for the family or, you know, good house in Sydney, they're long gone. You know, I live in a little box now, a long, long way from Sydney. But I think my kids notice I'm a lot happier. And I know I'm happy, and I kind of feel as I got a purpose, you know, till my last breath. It takes time. Mm-hmm. And you kind of have to check and do the experiments that you're doing the right thing, that you've got people that you can go to who sort of trust you. They allow you to explain your negative states if you've got them, lust, anger, or whatever, and say, okay, what's the antidote for that for you? Any questions from online? Hope this isn't too boring for them.
Any questions online? There is one question here. I'll read it out. Venerable, thank you for the insightful talk. Many things to consider. I like the theme of reading the mind being the most important book to read. It occurred to me as you were speaking that not only we need to read the book, but we also need to understand that we are writing the book each and every moment.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
How do we deal with the complex interplay of reading the book, understanding that we're also writing it, and then to understand that there is a choice to rewrite the text and to change the habitual tendency of the mind?
Well, I'm going to be a bit cheeky, but I guess the overview of what the Buddha was trying to say is you can deal with suffering, and there's a way to end suffering. So there was a famous philosopher, Pascal, who once said, and I'm going to adapt it so it doesn't sound sexist. He said, the problem for the man and the woman in the world is that they create most of the problems for themselves because they can't sit quietly alone in a room. So when you look at the mind and you say, how do you understand you've got the right context? You go to some of those other lists, which are really helpful, and say, with what I'm going to do with the mind next, is that going to be wholesome or unwholesome? Is it going to move me to peace, gentleness, kindness, and metta? Or is it going to set up a new round of arguments and dissatisfaction? So the test is, do I understand my mind enough that I can choose fairly carefully? And in present day society, you might say, I have to choose within a split second. I'm holding somebody up, or they're on the phone, they want this answer. How does it feel if you chose not to do that until you were ready? So somebody who impressed me 15 years ago, the YouTube clips are still out there. Have a look at Thich Nhat Hanh when he's answered a question, you know, by a child or even an adult at Plum Village. He's asked the question, And then he does this for 40 seconds. He holds the space and doesn't give the answer until he's ready. And if the answer isn't there that day, he said, oh, I'll come back to that tomorrow. But every time he was asked a question, he did the same thing. You might say, I think you're from Germany. I'm not sure I clearly understood what you said. Would you say it again? So he's clarifying that he's heard it fairly clearly, and he's tuning in to what that person might be looking for. For the second time, he might hold the space for 40 seconds. Now, I've always had a visceral effect when I've seen that, because it tends to bring my thought patterns down a bit. And I'm intrigued, like, that's a new technique, and it's only 40 seconds, right? But consciousness can work so fast. You've already given the answer based on the habits and preferences you are. And later you might say, oh, I wish I had said that yesterday. I didn't give the best answer I could because I was thinking about something else when I was asked the question. So yeah, lots of resources out there. You know, we all know that SuperCentral is a great site, but go and look for the texts or the abbots, the good monks and nuns who've written up. How do I know that my mind states are improving, or how am they getting better? And again, part of the test for me is, whatever situation I am, do I want to be in metta, compassion? I pick one of those and then say, I'll respond with that now. I kind of know a lot more. I don't want to give a knee-jerk reaction. And if I'm not ready today, it might be Friday. Can I just give one more example? I'm watching the clock fairly carefully. So this is a story against myself. So in the last three relationships, before I became a monk, I kind of knew by then that most people, when they get together, they show their travel brochures. They put up an impressive set of, if you're with me, it's going to look like this. But when you actually get to the destination, you find that the travel brochure is not necessarily the right impression of what you're going to find, and you know the pool's dirty or the rooms are difficult. So society sells that you meet the perfect partner, you're going to be happy ever after. Walt Disney. So if most relationships are set up on that, and then we have a fall 6 weeks in, 12 weeks in, 3 months in, you know, a year. I thought it was more important at the beginning of a relationship that you negotiated with someone, it would be better to have the skill about how to deal with conflict and confrontation, as opposed to love bombing each other with flowers and off to the cinema. And Thich Nhat Hanh, again, had done this wonderful thing years before. He'd come up with a peace treaty when people had conflict and confrontation. And it fits on one piece of paper, and it says, I'm filling my name. My lay name was Stephen Mayers. So I, Stephen Mayers, felt real anger when you abused me in front of our friends and said I was a hopeless husband and I wasn't good around the house. I want to understand where you're coming from, but I'm not in a good position to resolve it today. Today being Wednesday, can we meet on Sunday? And I want to understand from you what it is I'm doing wrong, and I can put right in the relationship. But importantly, in the meantime, I'll take care of my anger and emotions. I'll still be here and be present. And I'd ask you to do the same. Could you resolve it? I thought this was absolute gold. Like, if you negotiated that at the beginning of the relationship, then to the problems that will always arise, you had a solution. Here's the dobbing. Three times when it was needed, neither of us got the peace treaty out. And the times I've mentioned that recently, I said, well, of course you wouldn't. You know, it's unrealistic that you would even suggest that, because I needed to express my anger. Well, you don't. We do, but you don't. In the sense of, if you manage to find a 40-second gap, if you kind of went off to the bathroom and sat there for a few minutes, and I'm going to come out and engage, and I'm going to engage differently. I'll have this as an experiential experience. The Peace Treaty has got all the elements of Buddhism in it and says, if I respond with anger right now, that's not loving kindness. And if I say too much, the relationship may be over or it's damaged. Or if we don't deal with these things, we'll build up this grudge list. And a year from now going, I've got 16 issues. Yeah, I've got 16, but they're different to yours. Oh, well, we should pack it up. We should finish. One of my best friends in Perth, he has a meeting with his wife. They've been married 40 years. They have a meeting every Saturday in Perth. They review the past week. And they apologize if the other person said, you know, I was a bit unhappy about you handled that issue. So by Saturday noon, after a nice tasty breakfast, they've cleaned up any business of the previous week, and they may have set a new agenda for the following week. How much does that cost? It often comes for free, yeah? Does it have any benefits? I think so. I think they're a good standard in lay life to say, lay supporters, long-term meditators, they're looking at on a basis and saying, how do I work with somebody else on this? Sorry, a bit of a long answer, but I hope it helps.
Thank you. There is one comment here. Oh, there's a couple of comments rolling in. Bhante, I love your comment on how you found meaning in your life till the very last breath. I found that very beautiful. I wish you could impart this ability to all of us, perhaps a Dhamma talk for another time. And another comment from Sin Sin. Venerable, thank you for your insightful talk and advice.
So just perhaps as a final one, because I'm watching the clock, and for many it might have been a long day. So the gift I was given, you know, at 61 is I can do the work I always wanted to do in the world. That when I was paid for it and it appeared as though I was at a high level, was harder to do than it is as a monk. So by that comment of you've got a purpose till your last breath, as long as you stay a monk, you've got a process that puts you in front of other people. Other people will come and seek help. Last week, I was the chief organizer of the Australian Sangha Association AGM and conference in Canberra. Monastics and lay people from all over Australia. And we were trying to get a better relationship with parliamentarians, or say some monasteries are struggling getting visas for certain monastics. The bhikkhunis, you know, need some help. Someone in the University of Adelaide has written, he's a PhD candidate, but he's putting a paper together like, how hard has it been for the bhikkhunis in Australia that they suffer with gender equity issues? There aren't any papers on anything like that in Australia. I think it will be a groundbreaking paper. The Centre for Contemplative Studies wanted to come and see whether we would collaborate with them, that they want to study all meditations, some shaman principles, spirituality across a number of religions, and see whether they can measure it scientifically. And again, that was really kind of enriching and nurturing. One story I'll share from that. The guy who runs the center is getting lots of calls from people who have bought the mindfulness app and are more distressed in using it than they were before. They're saying that meditation leads them to high levels of distress. So he started looking at the issue. So he managed to collect some data and said, many apps out there, $4, $5, whatever, of 100% that were purchased as mindfulness apps, only 70% of the 100% are downloaded. 30% buy it, and then they do nothing with it. They've handed over the money to the app developer. Within 7 days, that 70% using it on a daily basis is below 5%. The drop off is enormous. The government has thrown a lot of money at this and saying, well, if it really helps mental health and it's free, you know, it's relatively cheap for the consumer to buy, this must be a good thing. He says, no, that's the wrong question and the wrong answer. If it's not being effective and people are putting it down so quickly, and it may be based on mindfulness, but isn't, you know, meditation and have some other skill set with it. And now the app companies are fearful that they're having complaints that hasn't improved my depression, I'm bipolar, doesn't work, you know, X, Y, and Z. So in some respects, we got a long way to go, but I can sort of balance having a bit of management skill and saying, is that going to be wholesome if we talk to the parliamentarians, if we help these centres? And then you can kind of have a balance, which I've been advocating, that says each moment can be a moment of meditation. Like, is that going to be a wholesome relationship? Is it going to suck too much energy out of me and my colleagues? Is it going to take too much time of Ajahn Brahm's time? But practice till your final breath, as it were. I don't think that's a bad way to go. I've met a lot of wonderful people, got lots of spiritual colleagues. I've been in a much better, happier place than in a lot of my sort of corporate jobs. And I get to see more people smile, laugh, and have a bit of fun on a daily basis. That might be a good place to start.
Wonderful. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Thank you. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to hand it back over to you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Venerable, for the insightful talk and lots of useful tips and things to consider that we could take home and implement. I find the getting out of your own way very useful. I mean, it's simple, but not easy. thank you, everyone, for your presence and your questions. We'd like to invite you, Venerable, if it's okay, to give a closing prayer or dedication of merits.
Okay, very happy to do that. I like to give a statement or intent that is based in Buddhism, but something that we can take into the night and tomorrow. For everyone present here today, and your extended family, and all those that you love and cherish, may the merit of practicing Dharma, having real debate with each other, trying to understand the mysteries of the mind, and how we can ease the human condition. May the merit that you brought by attending and sharing and caring for each other, may that go to you, your families, those that you care about. You remember over the coming days to fire that up with metta. Use compassion. Have lots of sympathetic joy for someone who's had a lovely surprise. And sit in contentment. So may you be blessed, may you be happy, and may the Metta Center grow and grow. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you so much, Venerable. Really grateful for all your sharings. Before we close off, I have a couple of announcements for exciting upcoming events for all, of the Metta Center. So next session again, next week again, we have the same session at the same time, 7 to 8:30. Don't really know the topic yet, but maybe a surprise for next week. Just rock up. Also join us for our non-residential 2 days meditation retreat with Venerable Vimokka on the 8th and 9th of July. So it goes from 9:30 to 5. Yes, it's non-residential, so kind of like a cool urban retreat. And the event will be held both in person and in Zoom. So there's no excuses why you can't make it. and like we'll be exploring, you know, both summertime Vipassana practices and some other forms of meditation. Also, we have our rejuvenating yoga classes still running in the month of May. So Yvonne Dang is teaching it every Tuesdays from 6:15 to 7:15. And you'll go through till 30th of May. So please come and join us for some mindful movement. And also, so like very exciting upcoming event, the Metta Convention Week. So many volunteers have, you know, put their brains and hard work together to make this possible. And that Metta Convention Week opens with the Buddhist Bowl Trivia. How interesting. And that's on Monday, 25th of September at 7 to 8:30. So just stay tuned for that week. There's so much going on. Lock into your calendar. End of September to the 1st of October. There's also the Metta Convention weekend. So, you know, things always end with a wah, which is the Metta Convention. And it's called the Metta Olympics, playing the games of loving kindness. What a suitable topic to continue what we've discussed today with Bhante, your topic today as well on loving kindness. And yeah, so the Metta Convention will be on the 30th of September and 1st of October, and it'll be like 2 full days. So basically that's going to be a transformative weekend of meditations, teachings and discussions with renowned Buddhist teachers from around the world. And the Metta Convention brings together, you know, leading Buddhist teachers and different traditions. And we'll explore topics relevant to modern living and deepening our spiritual practice.
Yeah, and Elisa, that begins on the 25th of September, and the trivia, it's like playing the Olympic Games, so it's going to be the trivia, as you said before, it will be a battle, but of course, like non-violent battle between Ajahn Brahmali and Bhante Sujato, so yeah, and people will have a chance to also participate in the trivia as well, so more information will be provided later. And by the way, next week the session will be held, will be delivered by Venerable Brother Phapai from Plum Village, and the topic is 10 Suchness. So that's next week, next Wednesday.
Cool, thank you, Sinsin. And Sinsin has also just posted a link about the Metta Convention if you guys want to check it out. Thank you. Actually, before we finish, if you want to join, if you haven't already, joined our WhatsApp group for cool conversations and updates, follow the link. There's a link on the newsletter. And if you haven't already, you can subscribe to our emailing list. And also like us on Facebook and Instagram so more people can get the benefits from our wonderful events organized by our wonderful volunteers and Metafield team. And if you'd like to support us so that we can continue running these events and other free services to the community, we would appreciate for your kind donation. And that's all for today. Mindfulness a day keeps dukkha away. So hope to see you guys next week. And thank you so much again, Bhante Metaji, for your amazing talk.